From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in enriched Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Ellen Burns-Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Will Bredbeck, a self-described creative guy, to discuss his experiences as a designer, artist, and creative director. So, if everyone's ready, let's start.
Quick correction up the top, Ellen. I believe Will described himself as a creative dude.
Oh, I'm sorry. Creative dude. Take it again.
Hello, Will. Welcome to the show. Yeah, and welcome. Why don't we get right into it from that angle? You have a job title, but who cares, right? You describe yourself as a creative dude. Tell us a little about that.
Tell you about being a creative dude or tell you about not really wanting to have a title?
Basically, I'm just asking you to explain yourself.
Yes.
However you choose.
I'm not really into titles too much. I believe we're all creative people, and I'm just leaning into that. That's what I like to do, and that's what people pay me for.
Nice.
Yeah. Cool.
Well, tell listeners a little bit about your what you're working on and what sort of what you have been worked on to the point where you're like, I've done enough. I no longer need a title.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's really helpful. Actually, I love to tell the story of my creative career path because there's so many. I teach also. Some people give me the title of professor. My students all find it really helpful to hear my story because a lot of them I find they don't have any idea what they want to do with their lives. And they think game design sounds really fun. So that's why they're there at that point. But
I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I literally knew nothing. And the twists and turns that my career path has taken hopefully might be interesting to someone.
Sure. Yeah, sounds good.
So I went to school for illustration. I didn't even know if I wanted to do art at all, you know, going into college. But it just sort of was always something I was good at. I graduated in illustration. And this was the era before the internet really took over. And so all artists' portfolios were... artists didn't have portfolio websites. You actually had to take your illustration portfolios by hand to these different magazines and different places and drop them off for a couple of days. And somebody would look at them and then say, we don't like your work. And then you'd have to get your portfolio and take it to someplace else. And this was all in Manhattan. I was living in Manhattan and traveling all over the place. I had three different portfolios that I was ferrying different all over sorts of different places. So I said, what the heck? I'm traveling all over Manhattan and not making any money. I'm going to be a bike messenger. So while I was taking all the portfolios, I'm a bike messenger. I got hit every day. I was breathing bus fumes. It was this really horrible experience in the rain. You can't call in sick because you've got to pay your rent. Anyway, I got into a terrible bicycle accident.
Oh, goodness.
And I didn't have enough money to fix my bike. And I was going to move home with my mom. And that's the end of the story. Not really.
Right. I assumed as much.
Actually, my friend called me and said, how would you like a job animating on this TV show? And I said, yes, anything. And so I auditioned I only took one animation class in school, but I got the job in New Jersey working on this show called Kablam, drawing Henry and June characters.
Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with the show.
Yeah, and within a few months, I was the head of the animation for Henry and June on Kablam.
Oh, wow.
And my creative career, like, really took off. I was apparently not meant to be an illustrator, even though that's what I went to school for. And I became an animator on the show. And I stayed on the show until it was eventually canceled. And then I was really burnt out on New York City because I'm not a very urban person. And I wound up with the money that I had saved up from that, moving to Alaska and climbing mountains and doing oil paintings and things like that. And eventually the money ran out there. I came back to New York City because it was the only place I could find work. And I decided I really didn't want to do animation because I was 3 years, I was drawing those same people, Henry and June, over and over. To this day, when I am just doodling, I'll doodle Henry and June because I would work 60 hours a week drawing Henry and June over and over and over again. So the only place I could find work doing animation was video games. And video games had this, at the time, had this really quick cycle. There weren't these giant AAA games. There were these little games. And I started working on these Flash games for Adult Swim and Cartoon Network and Nickelodeon. My first game was Head Kicker 2 with Brack. On Adult Swim.
Mm-hmm. And that one I'm familiar
was all
with.
Yeah. And that led into getting a job at Arcadium, which was a casual games company in New York. And some things that I did there that you might recognize if you're a certain age. There was a game called UB Funkies. Where I was the art director for, and that went through five different series. It was very successful. I made all of the virtual worlds and all of these games, but it was these action figures that you'd plug into your computer, and it unlocked different worlds and games within it. And it preceded Skylanders and was really this sort of thing that was a predecessor to that. Hmm. I also worked on Solitaire, Microsoft Solitaire. The purpose of Solitaire, the original 90s Solitaire, was to teach people how to use the Windows operating system. And when I was working on it, they were making Windows 8, which was a giant sea change in the way that people interacted with Windows. So they needed a new system to teach people how to interact with the new Windows 8, which turned out to be just too much of a change, and nobody was ready for it, and everyone hated it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that one of the things that's interesting about that Solitaire is it did do the same thing. Like, people who did play it were like, this is so different from the Solitaire I know. And then they loaded it up full screen and used their finger, and suddenly, like, oh, okay, I get it now.
Yeah, yeah.
Just in the way that the original one taught people how to use a mouse.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still really, I'm proud that they're still using the same artwork that we made for Solitaire. Even now, it's over 10 years. And I'm not sure. It might be longer than the original artwork was in the game. I think it is. Anyway, I don't know. But let's see, what else? Oh, we made a game called Twisty Hollow, which was a Gold Pocket Gamer award-winning and Starbucks game that I was really proud of. But eventually, I started to question my role making these types of games and like what effect they were having on the world. And I changed to educational games. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm making gamified experiences and educational games that try to make the world a better place. So that's where I'm trying to devote my superpowers. Mm-hmm. And also still making comics and drawing and making paintings and things.
Yeah, one of the sort of, we're sort of kindred spirits in a way, because I, like, what I'm hearing in that background is, here's all the things I did, and then it led me to doing something else where I can bring those skills rather than climbing a mountain or a career ladder or something. It's just every so often you want to do something different. And I imagine it often felt like starting over.
Oh, yeah. You know, and that's also when I started teaching. Mm-hmm. You know, I was at Arcadium as the director of design there. You know, that was my title.
Yeah.
And that's sort of when I got burnt out on all that stuff. And I started teaching at the NYU Game Center and then at Parsons School of Design, teaching game stuff. Yes. So, you know, sort of redefining. I've always loved helping younger designers get started, you know, even from Kablam and Henry and June. I think Mark Merrick, the guy who came up with a lot of that stuff, you know, saw in me somebody who likes to nurture people. So that's why I became the head animator there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a through line to your current work you do, which is that nurturing instinct. If I may just draw a broad conclusion from the brief story you've given, that kind of like workplace role is now maybe finally something you're actually producing as well. Does that sound right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one great thing, I so believe in the things that I'm working on, I'm really able to inspire others and to be passionate about what they do. I think everybody should be passionate about what they're doing. And I used to inspire my coworkers by saying, hey, we're making fun and we're bringing fun to the world and we're making solitaire and we're making things that are fun, maybe that are keeping older people's minds active. But after a while, there's other things at play too, that I felt like I was lying to myself about. Hmm. It's very easy to, with what I'm doing now, to justify everything I'm doing. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, Mark, you were mentioning, because if you have a similar experience in being able, you know, having moved kind of laterally, but like diagonally, you're not necessarily starting over, but you're finding a new angle to approach the creative process. And so I think, you know, one of the things we talk about with folks who've had similar careers is how many pivots have you done? But what we don't always get to is why did you pivot in the first place? And sometimes it's just, you know, a nebulous feeling. It's just time to make a change. Sometimes it's, you know, you're just excited by new types of problems. And what you're saying, Will, is the reason that you made your more, you know, most recent pivot perhaps was because you, you know, didn't like the way that things were necessarily shaping up in terms of the product that you were working on. And so you found a new environment with enough similarities to kind of like scratch the same itches and build on your existing skills, but different enough to kind of start a new story or a new chapter.
Yeah. And who knows where the path will continue to lead. And I guess just to take it back to, you know, junior designers and students that might be listening to this, you know, you just never know where it's going to go. And also that phone call from my friend about working on Kablam, you gotta be open to opportunities like that for the pivot when it comes. You know,
yeah,
that was an unwilling pivot. That might not have been something that I would have chosen. I was sort of forced into that by a financial situation. I mean, it sounded super cool, but I didn't think I was qualified for it. And I just thought I'd try, and it worked out. And it's led from one thing to another. You know, a person that I worked on Kablam actually worked at the game studio where I worked, made Head Kicker 2. And I worked on games there with this game designer who got me the job at Arcadium. And then I managed Chris Newman and all these people that Ellen, we said we had worked with before, that, you know, got me the job at the game agency, which I sort of left that part out. But that led into EverFi, where I work now. And yeah, so make connections and be open to those pivots. I also, talking about pivots, I didn't really talk about the pivot to taking the full-time job at Arcadium, which is kind of interesting. That was a really difficult decision to make because at the time I was freelance and I was working on comics and games and my own animation and artwork and things. And it was a really hard decision to take a full-time job at a game company. Mm-hmm. But And a lot of my friends and even me like wondered, like, did I make the right decision there? Because all of a sudden I was working 40, 50, 60 hours a week. And I was doing that for over a decade. Mm. So there wasn't a lot of creative juice left for my own artwork.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other episode probably.
Well, it dovetails into your mentioning, like, you should be passionate about what you do. And that's a really easy piece of advice to hear, but it's a hard one to take in, right? But like you say, I've had this experience when I've worked, 9-to-5 jobs throughout my career in media and in games, that it does mean that it takes away what you were doing nights and weekends, which is what you thought kept you happy.
Yeah.
When you did odd jobs or whatever, and then suddenly you have a creative outlet at work as part of a big machine that you were happy to be part of and certainly happy to get the paycheck for.
Mm-hmm.
And then you find yourself like, I'm doing more creative work than ever, but I'm less creatively satisfied than ever.
Yeah.
And that is, I think that's a common thing people say. And, there's no like right answer to it, right? Because there's so many competing interests and concerns that you have in your life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mm-hmm. eating mm-hmm. being one of the a pretty important one.
Yeah.
So it's not like the advice is to not make those compromises.
Right.
But to be on the lookout for when you are making those compromises and know when the opportunity comes along where you can find a better balance, because you won't always be weighing all those factors when thinking about opportunities in front of you. You'd be like, oh, this would be a good opportunity, but it would mean, oh, it really mess up all these other things I've got going. And then, but you're not thinking mm-hmm. about other things that are what you're sort of making you consider it in the first place.
Yeah.
Which again, is not necessarily advice to always take that leap, but what you're saying in your mind, you want to be passionate about what you do. And it's easier said than done. But you shouldn't dismiss it as a sort of like, that's just dreamer thinking. We all say that, but really, is it true? It's really true, right?
It really is. Yeah. I mean, there's so many good things that EverFi is doing right now. And it's still a business. They still have to make money, but mm-hmm. somehow they're balancing the good they're doing with making money in a way that just feels really great to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm able to, while I'm not working full time on my own creativity, I do get to use my creativity for things that I think are really positive. And I do get some time. I've got more time now, I feel like. One thing, I work remotely. So no longer am I commuting from the depths of innermost Brooklyn to, the middle of Manhattan for 3 hours a day. Mm-hmm. I've got all that time to do stuff and be a dad and a husband. Makes sense for me right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eat Rice Krispie bars.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
Well, and you say the next pivot may be just around the corner, right? And I think that is one of the things you learn when you have a career like that is like, don't ever feel like you're at your final position.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, no matter how good it seems now, when you feel like, oh, this is finally figured it out. Finally, all the things are in place. Everything I've wanted. It's all work. It's all the little compromises that feel fair to me. I'm all set. It's like, well, okay. In 2 years, when it stops feeling that way, don't feel like it was a mistake to have done that pivot.
Mm.
Maybe that just means it's time for the next one, or at least time to look out for the next one, perhaps.
Yeah. The goal is not to reach some sort of like formula that leads to your perfect outcome that you can then sit in for the rest of your life, because you won't want that. You need change.
Yeah.
To some degree. Life. Yep.
This is what happens when you're busy making other plans or making other games or making whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And you change as a person too, right? Like in 5 years, it makes sense for you right now, maybe, but like in 5 years, you are going to be a different person, and what you're doing in the moment might not work as well, might not fit with you as well as it does with your current you, if that makes sense. Can I ask what was the name of the company you work for now, Will?
It's called EverFi, which was acquired a couple of years or a year, I don't know. I'm losing track of time, by Blackbaud, which actually rang the is ringing the stock market thing or something tomorrow morning. I don't know. For Giving Tuesday.
That's the right attitude to have about that kind of thing.
Yeah. I was going to ask, what can you describe a little bit about what EverFi does for listeners?
Yeah, EverFi, Fi is actually short for finance. And the goal of the company, it was started by these guys. They went on this road trip across the country and they saw all this inequality in, as they went across America and decided to do something about it. And they made this company to try and educate people who don't get financial education to try and reduce the wealth gap and, okay. and help people in need. And since then, it's really grown. They brought me on to make this Learn to Read app, an early literacy app. And that was WordForce. It's an app called WordForce. And specifically, it's for kids who were struggling with learning how to read. You know, all of these learning how to read apps out there, they're all like pastel colors and like, it makes an air sound. And so they wanted to make something which doesn't exist for kids who are older, who had no support at home and didn't learn how to read, but want to still be interacting with something cool, which, that's why I took the job at EverFi. I went from the game agency to EverFi because I really believed that this was a project that I could feel passionate and get behind.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the remit of the company is quite broad then. I mean, you just sort of described like the Fi is in the name and this is a big, and on their website, it's like a big pillar of that financial literacy. But then you're saying, but then there's this specific project, which seems almost entirely out of that wheelhouse. But I mean, surely there's a connection. But like, does that breadth attract you? Or is it more like it has a focus, but then there's little like branches that keep you sort of interested?
I honestly love the message and like working on the financial stuff, mm-hmm. but it would be hard for me unless they really let me explore my creative, crazy side to just work on finance stuff. Yeah. I have done mm-hmm. a bunch of finance stuff for them, but I get to work on a whole bunch of different things. And, that was the thing with Henry and June. I need to work on a whole bunch of different things.
Sure.
And these different apps and games and things all have a production cycle of a couple months. Mm. And that feels really good to me. I'm also, we made a course with the Truth Initiative about learning the facts about vaping, and it's something that a lot of people get in high school. A lot of them are getting education about, but a lot of people aren't getting education about and don't know all of the facts and truth about how that can get you started on be just as addictive as cigarettes and have as many health situations. So I'm doing a thing on vaping. I'm doing a thing on the opioid crisis. There's a whole breadth of things that they have extended courses into. And really, there's a bunch of companies now that are doing this sort of thing.
Mm. Okay. And I can see how I can kind of see how you moved on to work on these kinds of games, because like there's definitely more it has more of a if I imagine it feels more like it has a more tangible impact on people's, and specifically on people's education, obviously, but I mean like and maybe on people's lives as well, because I earlier you had said that like you oftentimes would help get people enthusiastic about work by saying that we're trying to make something fun for people, you're like developing something that will give people enjoyment, but that it sounds like that over time was not enough for you to continue working.
Yeah. So I we started out with flash games, right?
Yeah.
And then we went into Adver games. Mm-hmm. And actually, there was I told them that I wouldn't work on this, but they wanted to made a Camel cigarettes game.
Oh.
Mm. And Arcadium actually bought Advergames.com. Mm, mm-hmm. We made a Corn Pops game. We made all kinds of things. And
sure.
I told them I refused to work on cigarettes or anything like that. And they honored that. So thank you, Arcadia. and then I went through the whole phase of social games. You know, that's where Candy Crush came from and all of these games on Facebook. And that was this era in which games like Candy Crush were making $1 million a day. You know, there was just crazy money flying around all over the place. And we were talking about, you know, ARPU and the stickiness of things. And at some point, and if you don't know, these are all terms that you're like looking at your target users and you're trying to find the whales, you know, all of this stuff. And, you know, in the back of my head, it's like, yeah, we're providing fun. But, and then there's this other voice that I heard in my head that was saying, like, well, wait a second, isn't stickiness, isn't that like addiction? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Now, what's the difference?
Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I love games. I grew up with games.
Yeah.
I made games before video games. We had a whole wall. It wasn't books. It was just games, board games. And, you know, I begged my parents to get me a computer or some sort of video game or something. They wouldn't get it. I just made up all these games.
Sure.
I have this long history and love of games. I don't want to knock games at all. But there, I just feel like there's a right way and a wrong way to do games.
Yeah, that stickiness that is like, isn't that just addiction? And then you're like, well, isn't any game that invites you to come back, isn't that on that slope? And it's like, yes, but that's like, what is the point of it, right?
Right.
And if the point of it is just to come back a third time and a fourth time, then you know it starts to be different. Like that. I think when people use the word addicting when they talk about video games, they think about it in terms of like chemical addiction.
Yeah.
And there is that process that does actually happen. Mm-hmm. But I think like addiction itself is not by itself like the worst thing. You can be addicted to something and it can be good because of the thing it provides you, right?
Yeah.
Like it's just that the point is if you make something addicting and then it provides no value or does harm, mm-hmm. then the addiction is just services the harm.
Right.
And so I think people have a hard time with that conversation because they're like, well, if it's really fun and people want to play it, isn't that addicting? And what's the problem with that?
Right.
And it's like, well, actually nothing is really wrong with that. But that's not – you kind of have to step outside that argument a little bit, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if I'm understanding correctly, like some of it is also the intent, right? Like a lot of those Facebook games, their intention was to keep you playing so they could exploit people financially in a lot of ways. And I mean, I suppose some of the games that we develop now still do that, but like our intention isn't necessarily to, like, you know, to get people addicted and keep playing a game. Lord knows I've played too much Super Smash Brothers. But like it's more so that like Super Smash Brothers is really fun and I enjoy it, but its intention is not to get me to keep playing it over and over again to the point where I, you know, it's taken over parts of my life.
Right. And yeah, anything that's good for you can be bad for you.
Yes.
But I think it goes back to what you were saying, Will, at the top of the show, which is that as you work on stuff like this, it can be easy to talk yourself into,
right?
Like to justify any kind of design that leads to those things, because the language you use for it is like, well, if you really think about it, it actually is all fine.
Mm-hmm.
And like that sounds, from the outside, that sounds absolutely wild.
Yeah.
But from the inside, you really can make it make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think it makes sense, you know. When you're close to something, it's harder to maybe define the boundaries, where those boundaries might look crystal clear if you're further away.
That's true.
Right. And yeah, that does really resonate. I think in the way that I've played a lot of games, especially this year, I've been playing a lot of games with microtransactions, and some of them have, I don't know if I was like a blue whale, but I was definitely like definitely in one of the whale species in terms of how much money I spent on some of those games, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And one of the things for me as a player that I always try to do is like, okay, be aware of the transaction and keep having that conversation with yourself. You know, is this value, is this an equal exchange of value, or, you know, something that I feel is fair?
I'm not against microtransactions or anything. I love that.
Right.
Especially yeah. With so much indie development, the barrier of entry of making games has been lowered so much. Like, sending those people some money, I think is okay. You know, it's a good thing. So the game that I had trouble with was Civilization.
Oh,
I'm
no.
sure a lot of
we talked about that on the show before.
Yeah,
yeah. And you know, there's chunks of my life I can't remember. Mm. Honestly,
yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And was I having fun? Yeah, I was. But I was not making things, and I don't look back on that time as time well spent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love things. There are people, you know, doing things like I love that, how Wii games like would remind you like, hey, maybe go out and take a walk or the play cycle of some of those games was shorter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, so introducing natural like breakpoints,
right.
Yeah.
or the dawning of location based games, like getting people outside and actually moving around for Pokemon Go or honestly, like geocaching, I think is an amazing game.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
that, you know, getting people out and like doing things,
yeah.
having experiences that might not be in the game while you're playing the game.
Yeah, and it really comes down to like design motivation. So, like a yeah. Wii game that tells you to take a break. It's like, well, why would they want you to stop playing? It's like, well, because engagement is not their goal.
Right.
They have your $60. They're,
yeah.
They're done with you.
Yeah.
Like. that doesn't harm the design. There's no barrier to putting something like that. Seems radical, but like it's actually fine just to, I mean, all they have to worry about is a bad review when someone says this game only, you know, I only put 2 hours in this game, it's not fun.
Yeah,
like that. But past that, like there's no reason a game should care how much you play it.
Right
mm-hmm. And Civilization's a great example because it also has your $60. I mean, it has a DLC strategy, but let's set that aside for a second.
Right.
Because I actually think, like, that's not entirely motivating for the design. I think the designers really just do love that one more turn. They make jokes about it. They talk about how addictive it is, and they feel comfortable doing that because they're not doing microtransactions.
Yeah.
As if that makes it okay.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just because we don't have a mature, sophisticated enough understanding of this topic that we reduce it to, well, does it hurt the pocketbook? Are you exploiting? So like, Ellen, you put a lot of money into microtransactions, but like, whatever, you paid for some games. So like, I won't pass judgment or let you off the hook, but like that alone is not the metric by which you decide
right.
whether you made a mistake or not.
Right.
And
it's not really
like the burden of you. It's the burden of the game designer to because it's not always the impact on a single player, it's on the player base, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. For sure, a designer would have to make, you know, consider the player base as a whole. As a player, you know, I don't regret that time. I don't regret that money spent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it stopped, just because I kept prompting myself to just be aware of what I was doing and make that choice, not just once, but like continually. I stopped when I felt like I was no longer like getting the exchange that I wanted, then I stopped playing and it was fine. And I have a great,
mm-hmm.
you know.
But what a weird, perverse thing for a game design to do is to force you to develop that discipline. What a weird thing.
Yeah.
Right? For to impose
yeah.
that
yeah.
on you as a player. Just so bizarre.
Well, I'm curious because this is the interesting thing, right? Because, Will, like, this dynamic is totally different when you're making educational games, right? Mm. Like, it's
almost
different set. Yeah.
In a way. Because the challenge, it is not hard to get someone to play, you know, all of these games we're talking about.
Yeah.
But with, when you're trying to teach somebody something, when you're trying to teach somebody about opioid addiction, Believe me, there's a whole bunch of high school students that are like, oh my gosh, I have to click through this thing, I have to do this. Just click, 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 click. You know, and it's all about making this something that they want to learn about. It's using those things that I've learned in an almost, I don't want to say an evil context, but those skills that I learned and trying to put them towards a good purpose of you know, making this relevant to them and engaging them right off the bat and making this something that, you know, they see as something that affects them, that they want to learn about and they want to interact with and find out more information with. And that's the constant challenge with a lot of these things.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, like, the whole idea of gamification has kind of like a sour impression a lot of people, because it's like, oh, it's lying to people to convince them something's more interesting than it actually is. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how people think of it. Mm-hmm. But, and that's the challenge, right? Is to, like, actually get people engaged, use the mechanics of play, and use some of those skills of like you said, that, you know, to, a useful shorthand in other evil contexts, even if it's not fully fair. Using those. But, you know, it's like, well, I mean, isn't that just tricking people like any other game does? And, like, you kind of have to wrestle with that, right?
Yeah.
Like, and because sometimes maybe that's what you should do, right? Because that, like, ends justifies the means sometimes. I mean, or maybe that's just, like, maybe that's just a bad strategy, and any game that does that is destined to fail. Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Telling any kind of story, it doesn't have to be a video game. It doesn't, if you're making a TV show, if you're writing a book or anything, you want to hook them and engage them right off the bat, or they're not going to get to the end. Right.
Well, yeah. And I think that, like, that's actually a good framing of it. Cause I think that, like, ultimately people can get a lot of understanding about yourself and other things through narrative, through storytelling. And so, mm-hmm. like, if you frame it that way, and that you're allowing players to tell a story that lets them understand the message for them better, that's a good thing, I guess. And that makes it more engaging for them, but it also makes that lesson more personal and impactful for them, and it makes it easier to retain that knowledge down the line.
Yeah.
Right, you don't have to like twist the topic.
Yeah,
it's yeah. I mean, easier said than done.
Yes, right.
But yeah, that's a great framing. That's
yeah. Mm-hmm. So I like that. I like that storytelling. That's a good. That's smart.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, Hollywood has made all sorts of interesting stories about extremely boring things.
Yes,
right. It's kind of almost the point of it, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's yeah.
And it's not all storytelling, I guess. I mean, sure. Because there's one thing I realized is that there's something in educational games called check for understanding. And in order to see if your games are effective or not, you have to have assessments. And every educational company does assessments differently, measuring, like, how effective was this at actually teaching people anything. And games like crosswords are actually a great check for understanding. It's a puzzle that you have to do and utilize knowledge in order to be successful at. So, you know, that's not a storytelling thing, but it's a very engaging mechanic. At Arcadium, you know, I made the crossword that is the number 2, 3, 4, and 5 most popular online crosswords after the New York Times crossword. And it's always, like, one of the most popular games, that online games that you can play, that people want to interact with. And really, it's just another way of assessing your knowledge of something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting that crosswords are that popular. I guess it makes sense because you, like, get, like, random little facts, or you get to test your knowledge in a way that is almost meaningless.
Okay, I'll go to bat for crosswords.
Oh, okay, okay.
Do it, Mark.
Because I do the New York Times crossword puzzle every day. And fair enough. I solve every Monday.
Yeah.
And I get close most of the rest of the week. I'm not great at it, but I'm consistently not great at it.
Yeah.
But I like it because it is both trivia and deduction.
Okay.
In a way that very few other games are, because you can solve a crossword only knowing three of the clues in the crossword.
Yeah.
Because just by slow deduction.
Yeah.
That's not always the most ideal way, but the mix of those things is so satisfying. Mm-hmm. And then also because it gamifies learning.
Yeah.
Now I know who won the 1976 Tennis Open or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't care, but like,
but now you know. Yeah.
Right. But I know because I slowly filled in their letters from all the cross clues. Right.
Sure. Okay.
That's why it's endured because it's a very natural cross between those two different types of games, and they interact in such a profound way, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's another reason why I think it's a reason why. So I do the New York Times mini crossword every day. And I always race Eric, and he always beats me.
Wow.
Always. But that's okay. I think it's okay. Maybe I need to dig into that more. That's a different episode. We'll put that on the Patreon. Crossword therapy hour.
Yeah.
But there's also a game that I play every day. In addition to Wordle, like there's the mini crossword, there's Wordle, and then there's this game called Connections, and it's the same kind of thing. They give you like these... Yeah, there's like 16 different squares. Each one has a word, and you've got to figure out the four groups of four. And you know, the first one's so hard, but that last one is just whatever the remainders are. And there is something really, really satisfying about progressively like putting the pieces together.
Well, it's funny because when it came out, one of the things about Connections for folks who are familiar, the format is a direct lift from a British quiz show called Only Connect. Which is something I'd been watching for a long time, and their version of it is monumentally difficult. It's like college level quiz bowl. Like if you watch an episode of this show, one of the charms of it is that you might get one question right, and that feels great. It's that type of quiz show.
Yeah.
But their final round or one of the rounds is that connections wall that they call it, which is the exact same thing. And what's so satisfying about it is the red herrings. So you have a category like, oh, I can these five things all fit together. Well, okay, now you can't click four of those five because you have a 1 in 4 chance of being correct, basically. And so so you have to then set that aside and then see which one of those is the red herring and also belongs to another group. And so that it does the same thing a crossword does, which is that it leverages your trivia and deduction. I think people should definitely look up concept mapping for like a fuller or another way into that concept and why it's so great, rather than my pedestrian description of it. But I think it is telling that multiple people can come to the same design. It's not that these things are solved problems, but it's that there are tools to solve them that do exist.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You guys, did you see Will's cool shirts?
I did. I did pick a peek at some of them. They were very fun. I did like them. These designs are really cool, yeah.
They are. They're really different. So here's the goat doing Yoda. Yeah. And then there's the bee that's a zombie. It's an undead bee.
Yeah.
Is this
going?
Well, we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes.
But as long as we're on the topic of t-shirts.
There it is.
Right.
We got some, too. We got a nice Games Club t-shirt. It's so comfy. And it's got a nice design, too, if I may say so myself. I didn't design it, that was Mark. But...
Well, I'm blushing over here, but yes, it's nice.
Yeah,
it's a nice design.
It's
I'm
nice.
Proud of it.
It's comfy. It comes in plenty of sizes. It's easy to get. You can just go on our website, nicegames.club/shirt, and you can check it out there. Yeah, you should, you know, it's getting close to the holidays, too, so it might make a nice gift for someone.
Yeah.
If they're fans
of
the show.
Yeah, nice shirt, nice gift, nice Games Club.
Is every game an educational game?
Yes.
No.
In the broadest sense, so does it teach you something? What does it teach you?
Yeah, in the broadest sense, it would teach, all games teach you a thing.
But does it anything mean anything anymore?
Right, yeah. I think it doesn't teach you anything. I guess like I would argue that like the things that a game is ultimately every game one of the goals is to teach you how to play the game. But like that information to be able to play this game is not necessarily useful information.
Right, and the skills you need to complete any game are skills you need to learn.
Yeah.
Or you already have and you need to develop or practice.
Right.
And so that is definitely what I mean, Ellen, you've talked about this a lot. There's a difference between like being good at a game and then being good at what a game teaches you.
Yes.
Right? And sometimes all it teaches you is how to play the game.
Right.
And that can still be satisfying or it can still be edifying or useful, I mean, in terms of like keeping your brain active or learning deduction or being able to spot patterns. Those are skills that are transferable.
Yes.
But they're abstracted, right?
Yes.
When you talk about educational games, the designer has a specific goal to impart education is part of a specific thing.
Right.
And that on its own, Ellen, you've said this a bunch of times, is not always the easiest thing to do by itself because then it just becomes a quiz, right? You need to use mechanics and those kinds of game skills to then teach that. And that's so challenging.
Yeah, it's hard to make, I think it's hard to make game mechanics. It's easy to make game mechanics that are basically oriented around quiz questions. But yeah, I guess when I said every game is educational, I think it's because I don't think we think about education the right way. Mm. Like we think about education as like this place that you go to get it and then you're done. But the way that I think about education is you are graining the brain. You are changing your brain because you're taking in stuff. And it's shaping the way that you, like your experiences shape the way that you perceive things. They shape the way that you make understanding out of your experiences.
Yeah.
And even if you're playing, you know, Cookie Clicker, that is doing something to your brain. And I think we should think about education more like that, what we're doing to brains, and it never stops. And in that sense, yeah, every game is educational. It's just like it might not align with state standards.
I totally agree. And it's interesting you bring up Cookie Clicker. I was like, try to think of a game that's not educational. And there's this great game called Stacks, which is basically a financial education cookie clicker.
Mm. Love it.
So you've got you put money in a savings account and it's earning interest, right? And you take that interest and you reinvest it. And then over time, you learn these different, just like, you know, in you build, I can't even remember, you get like bigger ovens or something in Cookie Clicker. Like you do things to make more cookies, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
You learn about different investment mechanics that will make your balance of money grow faster in Stacks. And it's exactly like Cookie Clicker, but you're learning about all of these different investment vehicles and things as you're doing it. It's really cool.
Yeah, that's like the power of context, right? Because a lot of complicated topics can be imparted by just assembling things people already know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The challenge for a game designer is what does that person already know? And you could have a whole thing about assessing what they know and then using what they do and don't and then cobbling together the explanation, but that's actually, I mean, that's a job for AI actually. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, but like it's how do you design something for the proverbial player rather than for a specific player? Cause when it's the difference between tutoring and lecturing, right?
Yeah.
And games are, you know, tend to only have the capacity for lecturing in my metaphor anyway,
sure.
than individual tutoring. Right.
Okay.
Well, yeah, well, and that's interesting because that's something that's changing with AI.
Yep.
It'll be interesting having this conversation in a year, you know.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
I mean, just the all I mean by that is like the ability to take in a lot of inputs and process them, right?
Yeah.
Which is just not something you can necessarily do with a simple, you know, if-else tree, right? You need a really complicated one. That's all AI is.
Right. Well, and that's part of what happens there is also the game designers. I mean, this is all related, right? It might just be like two sides of the same coin, but like one of the game designers, I mean, the game designer's core job is to make the experience of putting the puzzle pieces together fun.
Yeah.
Right. And that is also very individual. So like, what are people bringing to the game or to the, right. the learning game? If it's a, you know, game made with that purpose,
yeah.
But also like, what do people find fun? We know that's not the same person to person. Like, look at your three co-hosts.
And that goes right back to the concept of gamification and why we've soured on it is because in order to reach all those people, you need to go for the least common denominator.
Yeah.
Right. And that is doesn't feel right all the time. And it's not always yeah. effective if you're trying to do more than just get them to play or pay more, right?
Yes. There are still things. I mean, there are popular things that take off. Candy Crush capitalizes on people's desire to organize things. Mm-hmm. And Civilization capitalizes on, you know, these universal things that do try to cast as wide a net on audiences as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. The one that I find really surprising is Angry Birds. I think people were surprised by the success of Angry Birds, but the truth is that humans love parabolas. Mm. Like they love the physics of throwing something and watching the set of, like that is a core human instinct.
Yeah.
And something that like bringing that to a casual game, I think people thought like, oh, that seems complicated because it's physics based. That seems like something for gamers. No. That's a core human thing. And I think
I thought the appeal came from humans like to smash.
Well, Ellen likes to smash. We know that much.
There we go.
And I think that is satisfying for a lot of people. But that's the I think shooting a cannon at a tower is nowhere near as satisfying, I think.
Good point. Mm.
Isn't it interesting how game designers have, you know, astronomers have discovered all these things about space, and doctors have discovered all these things about the way the body works. And as a side effect of being game designers, we're discovering all this stuff like humans love parabolas.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, smashing things, and humans love organizing things. Mm-hmm. That's all solitaire is, and Candy Crush and all these, you know, it and humans love chance, you know, with bingo and slot machines, and humans love all these things. And we've learned that through game design.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Because the context in which those things generally, like tidying up, does not seem like the foundation for a million selling video game.
Yeah.
Because the context we you know grew up with of that is in contexts that are not fun,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that the human need to organize is like, well, no, everyone's junk drawer is unorganized. How could it be true that humans love it so much? It's like, well, because the context is different,
mm-hmm.
right? And you're exactly right. The games teach game designers what those things are because you can play with the context in a way that you can't so much in real life.
I'm constantly surprised by all the things that I like understand when I'm looking at like fancy like psychology papers or something like that. I'm like, I understood what this means. It's because I've been working on games for so long. It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
I definitely wasn't educated in it, but like, it's just, you start picking up on these kinds of things just because like you read articles or, you know, you observe players and they teach you things about how your game works, and you understand as a result what your game is doing to affect the players. Like mm-hmm. it's so cool.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Is that maybe the key to unlocking that sort of like the educational motive of a designer is to shift context? Is that always successful, or is there a point where it becomes too abstracted or confusing or perhaps unpredictable for the designer to engage in? Like, how much do you want to ground some of that in sort of like role play or real things versus like teaching a concept abstractly that can be applied to the real world? I'm asking the two educators in the room because I have no idea.
I'm going to leave this. I'm going to give this one to Will. Curious.
Can you say that again?
Well, okay. So that the power that like abstracting concepts has, is that like the secret? Or is there like a limit to that?
power that abstracting concepts, is that the secret to what?
To successful game design. To like, if you want to teach somebody something, you don't just want to Wikipedia at them. You show it in new context so that they can understand it. Is that always work?
Does it always work? No, mm-hmm. Absolutely not.
Mark,
but I think you do need to have some of that. I think that's what makes a good game design, is that you lean into some of these archetypal human needs.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't speak as an educator, but I would imagine that if you change the context too much, people will get the wrong message from the thing you're trying to teach them as a result, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I guess it's where you got to bring it home, right? Somehow.
Yeah, and at a certain point, like that abstraction can obscure the message that you're trying to expound.
Right.
I'm only thinking of this from a game design perspective because I've done that. You know, you'll teach it, you'll be like, this is how you're supposed to play this game, and then people will do the complete opposite or whatever, and you're like, why? Of course that's how they do it. So I imagine that's the same for, like, students, is they might approach something thinking one way and then getting the different message from what you were trying to teach them just due to the fact that, like,
well,
the context
it's another storytelling thing, is like allegory is powerful.
Yes.
But sometimes it's just more powerful to tell the story straight.
Yep. Yep.
You know?
Yep, absolutely.
Like couching it in so many metaphors can end up just being about itself at a certain point. So there's perhaps a limit. I guess ultimately my question is like, are games the same thing or not? And I like to say that everything is everything on this show, but like, I don't know how, there's a limit to that too, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know either. Teaching people is hard.
Ponder that one at home, folks.
Yeah.
Making good games is hard. I mean,
truly.
Yeah. Trying to do both at the same time is like really hard.
That should really just be our thesis statement for the entire program. Games are hard. I guess it is.
Yeah, I like how you said that as if we have not come to that conclusion 100 times.
We really have.
We have definitely. But you know, I will say I feel really good that Will said that because I say that all the time. It's like, okay, so game development is hard.
Yep.
Prospective client, and it's awesome that you want to do it, and you've never done it before. So I just want to tell you, you're making it extra hard by adding an educational goal to it.
Right.
But
right.
We can do it. That's good. Yeah. But it is. But it's rewarding.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things about working at a company that's education first and game.
Yeah.
Interactive gamification, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Second is. So the learning experience designers, you know, they are teachers. They're sometimes classroom teachers and not game designers at all. And they're like writing these treatises and all of these different concepts that you have to get across. And me as a game designer, and I'm sure all of you know that people don't read anything. You have to teach this stuff without anybody reading anything.
Right.
So how are you going to teach this like 30 page PDF? With all these facts and things, like through, and that, I love that. I know that I'm saying this is really hard, but I love a design challenge. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I find my work really engaging.
Yeah.
I think that should be an exercise. Anyone who's sitting down and trying to make an educational game should start with that premise. How do I teach this PDF without making anybody read anything?
Yeah.
You know?
I think, you know, when we talk about, I made this realization at one point, making educational games, that simulations are the best way to learn anything, you know, to learn empathy with somebody else, to learn. I was on the TV and I was looking, and I was like, whoa, they have games on Amazon Prime. And there was Sim Honeybee. And I got to fly around. I was a honeybee. Hmm. And a friend of mine, Alona Umansky, made this game, Aiti, where you are this family in Aiti. And it's a simulation of the family and trying to make ends meet. So you understand just what, you know, these people are going through. And that people are making like these VR experiences of Now, there's this great one, Traveling While Black, about the Green Book and, you know, traveling around in the South and, like, just putting yourself in those shoes of being somewhere else. And I really feel like we're not just through games, but through all kinds of different technology, coming to a point where we can get closer to being somebody else and walking in their shoes than we have in a long time. And that's like one of the most profound ways to teach somebody anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're here. So Will, here's my last question for you. I want to know what advice you have for new graduates and, you know, younger professionals who are either they're leaving college with their game design degree or they're leaving high school going, what should I go to college for? And they're thinking game development or thinking game design. And they listen to this episode going, oh, okay. Like what, how do I even get into educational game design? Like, how do I know if that's the right fit for me? What advice do you have for those folks?
Educational games specifically, or?
Yeah. Let's recruit. Well, recruit. Yeah.
You know what? I think it's really helpful to go into game design first. You should be a game designer first if you want to go into educational games. I've got a lot of pieces of advice. One of them is make games. Make lots of games. Make a bunch of games. You'll start to understand, you know, what's fun, what's engaging, and all those things that we were talking about, you know, these archetypal actions that people like to engage in that create that state of mind of play in people's heads. You know, that's what we're all trying to tap into. There's no way to learn about it, no class that's going to teach you. You just need to make games. You know what? Screw video games. Make board games. Make games with your friends. When I was a kid, I made a game called Statue Store, where, you know, one person was the client and one person was the customer and one person was the shopkeeper and everyone else was all these crazy statues. And the customer came in, and when they did, all the statues came to life, and it became this like crazy game of tag, but the statues had to act like the different things they were statues of. Anyway, so that's a way that you can make games really fast without even having any skills, mm-hmm. but just making games, I think, is really important.
Yeah.
Two, mm-hmm. make lots of contacts. Even if I don't, I've been in a position to hire people a bunch of times. I don't care anything about you.
I'm waiting for the end of that sentence.
Except like what you've done, what you can do. That actually doesn't have anything to do with making lots of contacts. What I meant by making lots of contacts, though, is that I've been able to hook people up through classes that I've taught, mm-hmm. People, you know, that you know through doing a podcast or doing all kinds of things. You never know where the next pivot and opportunity is going to come from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Three, getting to the point of that I was making before, have some way of sharing what you've done.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. you know, that could just be an Instagram account, or it could be a Linktree thing that you can send around, but you need some way to share what you're doing and what you've done with other people. To get back to what I was saying, like, I don't care anything about you. I don't care whether you've gone to school. I don't care anything. If your games are awesome and you've made really, really cool things, I'm going to hire you if you can help me with what I am currently doing. And, you know, anybody will.
It's really interesting that those are the things you hit on, because Ellen asked about like young professionals and people getting out of school. But of course, you know, also folks who are changing careers, right?
Yeah.
And for me personally, I made educational games before I made any other types of games when I was working in commercial video, because we would, you know, because that was also the days when, you know, if you wanted Flash work done, you went to a multimedia production house. You didn't always go to a game studio, right? And so that's how I started, you know, making a lot of Flash games. And I was doing things on, like, you know, for like Smokey the Bear campaigns or like workplace safety stuff and a lot, very traditional kind of sort of quiz style mini games and stuff, education. And so I had experience making those things, but I had none of the three things you're talking about, right? I didn't have, like, you know, a way to show those things because they weren't mine, and they weren't also the thing I was doing for work. So I didn't save them probably the way I did the other stuff, right? I didn't have contacts because I was in a different industry, and I didn't have a lot of experience making games. I just made a bunch of these educational experiences, and so I mean, I didn't go this route, but I could have seen myself, if I was interested in that, thinking like, oh, maybe I should make a career out of this, but because I'd had experience doing the thing. But and there's probably other people out there like that, and so I think that that is very interesting that you say that those things are important, because it's obvious to me now, years and years later, but I would not have been, that would not have been a successful career shift for me at that time, even though I was probably more qualified to do that than, you know, what I ended up switching my career to. So I think that's important for people to hear who have gotten a little taste of it and thinks it's interesting, is that those fundamentals are important. And it's particularly like make games, that the game part is the most important part, not because it's the most important part of the ultimate work you do, but it's the most important part for you learning how to do that ultimate work, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you can go right out of the bat and make educational games, great for you. That's awesome. If they're awesome, I say that because you have to build two things. You need to build your skill and your taste. You build skill by doing something a whole bunch of times until you achieve mastery of it. And you achieve taste by looking at and interacting with a whole bunch of things until you formulate an opinion about something. That's why both of those actions are really important.
Yeah. And in my case, I shortcutted a lot of that. So I don't think I had those things. But but at the time, I could have convinced myself I did.
Yeah. Sure.
So this would have been good.
Nobody
for
has
then.
These
yeah.
things at yeah. first.
For sure.
Nobody. Yeah. Everybody is on square one together. Yeah. You know? And we've all had to take our hits, you know, to get to where we are now. And everybody has to take that same path. And some people do have a more of a head start than others. And but there is nothing preventing anybody from eventually getting there if you work hard.
Yeah. It's good. It's nice to end on a positive note, a hopeful, optimistic note.
Yeah.
Which we sometimes have a hard time with.
Yes.
because why?
Either a positive note. Because I make jokes sometimes.
Because games are hard.
Also, because games are hard.
Oh yeah, because games are hard. Yeah. But not too hard. So keep trying.
Not too hard to do. So do it.
Yes.
Right.
And just one more positive note. Games can be a really powerful tool for doing great, amazing things, because games really are just a tool for unlocking that sense of play in your mind, which is a very powerful state to be in. And and we are not just in demand as game designers, but, you know, it's a really fundamental, important role that we are filling by engaging this in people.
Yeah. Absolutely. More positivity. Like it.
That sounds like a topic we might need to follow up on next season of the podcast. How games change your brain.
Sure.
That'll have to be for another day, because that's our show. You can find Will online at Instagram at WBreadBook. We will put that link in the show notes. For other notes and links from today's conversation, you can go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and the Normandy SR0 in Starfield.
Of course she would.
Reply on the various platforms or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. I'm really struggling with the pronunciation today. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at our nicest of 2023. That's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
Nice gift for someone.
Yeah.
If they're fans of the show.
Nice shirt.
Yeah.
Nice shirt. Nice gift. And nice games club.
Dang, that's a great slogan.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mark. What were you going to say?
That's fine. I'll just cut out my channel so I'm not interrupting you.
okay.